Okay. Questions? Yes. If it is admissible,
even if it is not, because it makes no change, so it
is. Yeah, it is. That's an interesting point. Except if I make the constant to be infinitely large, right? It is true that for certain constants, it doesn't matter. I mean, in fact, even if the heuristic is inadmissible, sometimes it might find optimal solution. Yes, in general, that's what it would be, except if you make that constant to be very large, right? Other questions?
I have a question about the programming assignment.
Uh-huh.
It's like the skeleton which is given, are we supposed to stick to it, or can we have something be...
You can rewrite it. I just made a skeleton that is easier. I mean, it gives you something to work with. That's about it. Okay. It's okay for you to rewrite it. What happened? If you didn't find yours, just write one more. Now there are some more here, so I don't know what this is. Other questions? Okay, so what I'm going to do today is continue with the discussions on heuristics for A star search. So this is just a quick refresher. So we looked at something like this on the board, so let's just go through this once very quickly. So suppose I have some problem for which these are the nodes and this is the heuristic value, and suppose this is the H star heuristic, which is the perfect heuristic for the problem. Okay, remember that since it's not touching zero anywhere, in fact it should be touching zero somewhere, and there is a problem with this picture. Okay, because if this is really the heuristic, that means this problem has no goal. You have to understand that, right? Because any heuristic, especially if it is admissible and perfect, I mean any admissible heuristic must be equal to zero at the goal node, right? Because that's the only way it will be a lower bound on perfect heuristic. And a perfect heuristic must be zero at a goal node. So there is a problem with this picture. In fact, it should kind of dip somewhere, but that's fine. Ignore that part. Okay. So there is H5. This is a heuristic. Is that admissible, informed? Not admissible, not informed. How about H4? Not admissible, because essentially it's crossing H star here. Okay. There are some which you cannot see, I think, because the colors are. Oh yeah, no wonder. Wait, let me see if I can make this. Yeah, those are the ones that you're unable to see. Background, make it more color. What can I do, like this maybe? Okay, now, oh, it looks even uglier. I can see it. No, you can, maybe you can see it, we'll see it. Yeah, that's H. So yeah, these are the ones you missed earlier. They came and you didn't know. Okay, this is H star. H1, is it admissible?
Yes.
H5, no. H4, no. H2, admissible. Is it more informed, less informed than H1?
More informed.
This is H3, it's written here. What about H3? How does it compare to H2? It can't, you can't tell, because it's clearly H3 is more informed than H1,
yeah.
But it's basically, you can't tell. Sometimes H3 is more informed than H2, sometimes H2 is more informed than H3. Okay, so then I can take the envelope of those. That's your envelope. Okay, that's the max of H2 and H3. If I take max of H2 and H3, is that more informed? Of course.
Yeah.
Is it admissible? Of course. if you take max of two admissible heuristics, you will still be admissible, and you'll and in fact you'll be at least as informed as the original heuristics, if not more. Okay. Okay, that's basically it. So keep this in mind. One other thing, maybe. So the general idea of this whole theory of informedness of the heuristics is useful. It is useful in the sense if one heuristic is more informed than the other, the more informed heuristic does fewer expansions in general. Except the reality is slightly more complicated. And I will show you, I probably won't discuss too much about this reality, but I'll show you that this exists in the slide, and you can keep that in mind. So for example, in this particular case, here is H star. Okay, again, you know, it's supposed to touch goal somewhere, you know, zero somewhere, but I didn't make it. Here is H star. Here is H1, here is H2. Which one do you think is more informed? Which one is more informed by just definition? H1. What do you think, using common sense, which heuristic is likely to get you better search performance? Why did you say that? Because H2 essentially is a translation of H star down. Okay? Whereas H1 essentially says everybody is just as good or bad as everybody else. Right? So now this picture makes you realize that informedness is a sort of a coarse characterization. Okay? In fact, what you really need to know also is, are you able to distinguish between good and bad nodes very well? Okay? So in fact, it would be great if you can distinguish just as well as H star. So if I had, let's say, H2 dash, which is even below H2, but exactly the same shape, then you can say H2 dash is worse than H2. But here you can't say H2 is worse than H1. But then what happened? I told you earlier that informed heuristics do fewer expansions. And yet you don't believe me, because here you believe that if you use this, you will do fewer expansions. What happens really is, as I mentioned last class, you have to read this very carefully, but what I mentioned last class was, remember that the heuristics, basically, if you think of, you know, this is the start node, and then in essence you are looking at F1, F2, etc., to F star, where F star is the F value of the goal node. Okay, in a way you can think of what A star search is doing as essentially looking at first all the nodes of, let's say, a certain value F, then little bigger F value until F star. Okay, now remember that unlike G, which is defined by just the problem, G is only defined by the problem, nothing else. Right? H, on the other hand, you make up. Okay, so the contours, F contours, would be different based on which H you wind up using. Okay, in particular, if you were to use H1 versus H2, what's likely to happen is H1 winds up putting everybody and their brother in the last, there are going to be too many nodes in the last contour, F star. Whereas H2 is more likely to have mostly just the goal node and a few more in the last iteration, in the last frontier. And the informedness theory essentially only says that for that all the nodes, so the number of nodes expanded whose F value is less than F star. Remember, F star doesn't depend upon the goal node. Oh, sorry, F star doesn't depend upon the H value. Do people understand that? F depends on H value, but F star does not depend on H value. Why? Because F at the goal, heuristic is supposed to be zero. F star is being established by the goal node. Okay? So F star is the same for both H1 and H2 heuristics. all that differs between H1 and H2 is who winds up being on these various various frontiers. And a more informed heuristic makes sure that it expands all nodes whose, I mean, so the number of nodes in the interior fringes, that is the nodes whose F value is less than F star, that it expands, is going to be much fewer, or at least not going to be more than a less informed heuristic. Okay? So you in fact can, if you were to do the testing, you will find H1 does expand fewer nodes whose F value is less than F star than H2 does. But H1 still can fail because it might wind up expanding many nodes whose F value is equal to F star. Because everybody looks like they are as good as a goal node. And all those guys have to be expanded, and you know, ties can be broken any random fashion. So in the worst case, you could be unlucky and wind up picking up all the guys with the same F value, you might pick the goal node, the last, just because of your bad luck.
Wouldn't you still do the same thing with H2? I mean, if several nodes have...
Yes, yes. All I, so all the real question is how many nodes have F equal to F star. We know that at least one node has F equal to F star, which is the goal node itself for both heuristics. But heuristic one might have many more nodes whose F value equal to F star than heuristic two. That's exactly what a bad heuristic does. It makes you think everybody is very good. And so you're basically checking to see whether they work or not, and that's going to be a waste of time. Okay? So anyway, this is sort of a more advanced treatment of that there is life beyond informedness. And I didn't have to tell you too much for you to realize that even though H1 is more informed than H2, you believe, I mean, you weren't going to believe me that H1 does better search than H2. So your gut feeling was already that H2 is going to be better. And I'm just explaining to you how it winds up being better. So when you do project, you can actually differentiate the number of nodes expanded into the number of interior nodes expanded, which is there, those are the ones whose F value is less than F star. And number of nodes on the F star fringe expanded. Now notice that in the beginning you don't know what F star is, right? Because you don't know where the optimal goal is. But after the search is over, you can go ahead and decide for each of the nodes that were expanded which were F equal to F star and which were F less than F star. And there would be nobody whose F equal is greater than F star. No node would have F greater than F star. That's as long as you have admissible heuristics. You will never expand a node whose F value is greater than F star. And again, F star is nothing but the optimal goal distance because H there will be zero. Okay. So just so you can understand, let's see if you can understand. What would be the heuristic which would wind up putting fewest number of nodes in each of these fringes? Fewest number of nodes in each of those fringes? H star. Because H star on the whole, in the basically what it will wind up putting is, in the first fringe it'll put about one node, then next one node, then one node, until the number of the depth to the goal. That's it. Okay, so that's the best. Everybody else winds up putting more and more nodes all over the place. And in fact, these guys, which don't differentiate between too many nodes and thinks everybody is as good as everybody, winds up putting all nodes here. And if you actually had H equal to zero, then you would wind up putting too many nodes in the interior fringes. Okay? Question? Yes.
I guess after hearing the rest of it, it's not as big of a point, but at some point you'd have to, that straight line one would have to come down to zero if it's admissible. So it would expand out like that, but eventually it would just sort of grab onto the.
Yeah. See, basically all I'm saying is the number of nodes which have f equal to f star. That is an important issue. If you have a million nodes whose f value equal to f star, one of them is the goal node. So on the average, you are expanding half of them before you find the goal node. In the worst case, you will expand all of them before you find the goal node. Okay, so it's a very important issue. And it matters whether or not you are distinguishing between different nodes. It's not enough to just know where the goal is. It's also important to know what is not a goal node and what is not leading you to the goal node. It's not enough to know who are smart people. You also need to know, who are helpful people. You also need to know who are not going to be helpful. Because if you assume every node is helpful, then you're going to waste your search. Okay? Now, of course, you will still have soundness in the sense and completeness. You will find the goal because you will be going in these iterations very carefully. Okay? But you would have to, but you could actually wind up spending a lot of time in the last iteration. Okay. So then the other thing that I did not complete last time, and I just want to complete it for completeness sake, is a proof that A star search is indeed optimal. I think you pretty much kind of figured this out yourself, but let's just do it formally. And notice that the picture looks almost exactly like the picture that I drew when I was trying to prove that uniform cost search is optimal. Okay, and the proof structure follows exactly the same way too. All I'm going to do is prove by contradiction. Okay, so let's assume that I found the node N, that my search found the node N as the goal node and stopped. Okay, and I'm trying to prove that there is no other node, other goal node, which can be more optimal than this. Okay. Suppose there is, so to prove by contradiction, let's assume that there is a node n dash, let n dash be another goal node, okay, such that, which is better than n. And the only way a goal node is better than another goal node is the G value is cheaper. That's it, right? So in fact, all that basically implies F of N dash, I'm sorry, G of N dash is less than G of N. Equal to doesn't matter. If both are equally good, picking one, there is nothing wrong. They're equally good. So this is your assumption. And the question is, can I then find a contradiction with respect to this assumption? Okay. And again, we'll argue that if in fact n dash and n were to be present on the search queue at the same time, if n dash and n were to be present on the search queue at the same time, then I argue that you would have picked, if this were to be true, you would have picked n dash rather than n. Why? Because both of them have h value equal to 0. So their f values is actually their g values. And I just said that g of n dash is less than g of n, so it must be the case that I would have picked n dash. So this is not a problem. If both of them are in the search queue at the same time, you could never have picked n instead of n dash. If they are not on the search queue at the same time, that's the worry. But if you are not on the search queue at the same time, if n dash is not in the search queue at the time n was being picked, then some ancestor of n dash must be on the search queue. Otherwise, how did it come in? And this ancestor can be anywhere up in the tree. It could even be n0. All I care is that there is an ancestor which is on search queue at the same time when n was about to be picked for expansion. Okay? Let that be n double dash, the node which is on the search queue when n is picked for expansion. Since you're just using a blind program, the program makes sure that since n was picked and not n dash, it must have been the case that f of n double dash must be greater than or equal to f of n. Okay, I'll write opposite way. F of n must be less than or equal to f of n dash, n double dash. That is for sure, right? Now, what is f of n? F of n is g of n plus 0. Because the h is 0. This must be less than or equal to g of n double dash plus h of n double dash. Okay? Now, what is h of n double dash? H of n double dash is really trying to compute the estimate of the distance between n double dash and n dash. Okay? Now, if I were to have g of n double dash plus distance, the true distance of n double dash to n dash, this would be nothing but g of n dash. Agreed? Because that's the optimal distance to come to n double dash and from there to go to n dash, the total distance. Except instead of using this term, I'm using h of n double dash. The only question now is, how does h of n double dash compare to distance of n double dash to n dash? It is less than or equal to. Okay? So, this guy is already less than this guy, which in turn is less than g of n double dash plus distance of n double dash to n dash. Right? Now, except this is nothing but g of n dash. So now I've just proved that g of n is less than or equal to g of n dash. I started with the assumption that is the opposite. So I have a contradiction. So that's the proof, essentially. Okay? And the proof went through only because this guy was less than or equal to the true distance. If it wasn't, you couldn't have proved it. This is why admissibility was needed. Now, given this proof, suppose I were to tell you that I have a heuristic which is not admissible, but at most it is epsilon more than h star. It's at most epsilon more than h star in any place. Right? So it's inadmissible, but it's not a very bad inadmissible heuristic. It just kind of is a little larger in one place. If I know that, then I can use the same exact proof to prove that if I were to use that heuristic, the goal node I would stop with would not be epsilon worse, would not be more than epsilon compared to the optimal goal. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because it's just the pluses, and we are doing additions. I'm not talking relative error. I'm talking, so h of n is at most, so basically all I'm saying is, for all n, h of n is less than or equal to h star of n plus epsilon. This epsilon equal to 0 for normal admissibility. Okay, if this is a case, then I can easily continue the same exact proof and show that the goal node that you would find cannot be more than epsilon longer than the optimal goal node. Yes? What? What do you mean? Any number epsilon. Any number epsilon. Okay, as long as at most it's epsilon more than h star for all over all the n, then I know that I could not find, I would find a goal node that's at most epsilon more than the optimal goal node. Okay, that's an interesting thing to know. Okay. Questions on this?
So if you're willing to accept a very small amount of non-optimality, then, and you can make a heuristic that is a lot cheaper to compute at the cost of occasionally going above.
That's a good question. So that's basically, yes, if I in fact have an inadmissible heuristic, which is reasonably easy to compute, but at most it will be like 5 more than the optimal, and you proved it to yourself somehow, then you know that you're going to find, if you use that heuristic, then you're going to find an optimal goal, a goal which is at most 5 more than the optimal goal, 5 units costlier than the optimal goal. Nice. I mean, and it's basically the only reason I brought this up. I don't quite think that you will ever find a practical use for this. It's not all that easy to find heuristics which are only epsilon more at most than H star. Okay? But it's kind of, this is a cute way of using the same proof to actually say that if in fact you have that property, you can still get optimality. I'm sorry, you can still get epsilon optimality. Okay? But it's not factor, it is basically just epsilon more. The distance would be epsilon more, okay, than the optimal. Okay. Any other questions on this? Okay. So what we're going to do next is continue the discussion we had last class. We did this, right? We talked about where heuristics come from. Okay, which is in some sense the most interesting stuff, but that's the art form, unfortunately. Okay, but it's not too much of an art. I'll tell you, as I told you, if you get abstractions of the original problem, okay, the more concrete the abstraction is, that means the less of an abstraction you do, the more of the real problem you are considering, and so the estimate in that would be closer to the real cost. But the general idea is start with the problem, abstract it, solve it optimally in the abstract space, use the distance in the abstract space as the heuristic value for the concrete space. Except you do have to understand the following thing. In order to go from one single node start to one single node goal, that's all I wanted to do. Okay? To compute a heuristic doesn't just tell you the heuristic value for some of the nodes. It has to tell you heuristic value for all the nodes. Okay, so in essence, what you really have to do is, given any node during the search, let's say n, you should quickly go into the abstract space and find the optimal path between n and g. That would be the heuristic value. Either you could have pre-computed it beforehand and stored it in a table, or you could have done it on demand. It's completely up to you. But in this particular case, you know, assuming all the obstacles go away, it's so much simpler because it's just that computation is straight line distance. If you have circular obstacles, it's slightly harder. If you have polygonal obstacles, it's slightly harder further.
What would be an optimal, like take the circle example, could you give me an example of what, you know, you pick a node that's up and to the left or something, one step up, how do you calculate then the shortest way?
That's a good point. I mean, again, we are not interested in solving this problem, but if you are, what you would do is, suppose this is the goal node, this is the start node, right here is the circle. So what do? You basically find the tangents, okay, and go to any of the tangent points and go from there to the goal node. Okay, and this idea can be expanded to any general type of obstacle. Circles are the easiest ones to handle. Right? Because, I mean, you want to just graze and get by. I mean, what you really would like to do is go like this. But this guy is stopping you. So you want to make the smallest detour possible. But clearly, this takes you a little more time to compute than this, which was just plug it into the formula. And it would take even more time once you start having generalized cones. In fact, if you were to be interested in robotic path planning, which is just this problem, there are a whole number of approaches. There is this idea, by the way, it's already a very old idea. This is called using generalized cones. And it's costly. The closer the approximation to the obstacle is, the harder it is going to be to compute it. Okay? But then it will be more informed. And which is why I pointed out this picture to you last class, and this is like an important picture to keep in mind, that if you were to think of this as HD, which is the Euclidean distance, HC, which is a circular abstraction, and HP, which is the polygonal abstraction, and the actual, Okay? If I were to put in the x-axis the names of the heuristics, okay, and so this is H0, HD, HC, HP, and H star, and I draw two curves. Curve 1 essentially is the cost of, the total amount of computer time I spent computing the heuristic. Okay? And clearly, as you go from here to here, it's going to increase. And it's going to increase sort of exponentially. But if you have H star, you do the least amount of search. If you have H equal to H0, which is ignoring all heuristics, you will do the most amount of search. Right? So the question then is, what are you trying to optimize? Obviously, if you want to do the least amount of search, you should be here, but you don't get here without having computed that much time in computing the heuristic. Really, what you're trying to optimize is the total. Right? And if you add up those two curves, the total would look something like that, and you're trying to essentially, if you are trying to ask the question, what is the best heuristic for this problem? This is the best heuristic. Whatever is the heuristic here is the best heuristic. Okay, that's the one to keep in mind. So it's not that you want to reduce the heuristic computation cost completely, or it's not that you want to reduce the search cost completely. Somewhere in the middle is where this optimum occurs. Now the real $1 million question is, depending on the problem, this minimum might occur here, or here, or here, or here, depending on the problem and the spectrum of heuristics you are looking at. One interesting thing was the old wisdom in the heuristic community was, do less amount of work in heuristic, in computing the heuristic. Okay, so they sort of assume that this minimum will occur somewhere here. But more and more we know that depending on the problem, you may have to spend a lot of time computing the heuristic to do overall well in the search. Okay? Okay? So I'll make this picture again with respect to 8 puzzle problem that you all care because you have a project to complete. Okay? There too we will talk about how to compute much costlier heuristics, and in fact argue that the much costlier heuristic wind up being better. Okay? Any questions on this?
So is that H star point possibly representing a heuristic that just goes off and evolves itself?
Which one? This H star is always the perfect heuristic.
Yes.
By definition, H star is the perfect heuristic. Okay? Yes? No, but you don't quite know what H star is. H star is actually solving the problem. So the idea would be, during the search, you are doing the search to go from S to G. Okay? Here is a way of computing H star. When you came to node N and you're trying to compute its H value. So start a subroutine which does H star search with an admissible heuristic to go from N to G. And whatever that distance is, that is the heuristic value. That's H star. Okay, obviously it's a dumb idea. In trying to solve one optimal cost, you're trying to find optimal cost for every node that you will ever see during the search. Okay? Other questions? Wake up. Other questions? By the way, those nice things that you have in front of you also help me tell who is sleeping. So it would be nice that you actually keep it up when you're sleeping so that I know. Other questions?
And the minimum could occur very close to H star if it happens to be very easy to compute the cost of. But
depends. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Let's look at our problem that we all care about. 8 puzzle problem, okay. What are the two abstractions that you can care about? in the eight puzzle problem. The simplest ones, you heard about this, several people have been sending me mail saying, what is this misplaced tiles and what is this Manhattan distance? Okay, here you have the misplaced tiles essentially compute. So suppose this is the goal configuration and this is the initial configuration. The misplaced tiles computes the number of tiles that are in the wrong places. That's it. Just the number of tiles that are in the wrong places. Okay, so how many number, so for example, 5 is in the wrong place, that's 1, 4 is in the wrong place, 2, 6 is in the wrong place, 3, 1 is in the wrong place, 4, 8 is in the wrong place, 5, 7 is not in the wrong place, so I won't count it, 3 is in the wrong place, 6, 2 is in the wrong place, 7. What? Okay, that's a very good point. If you won't count blank as a tile, we're only caring about tile. In fact, if you were to count the blank, you can show that it's inadmissible. Because blank moves when other things move. So for example, simplest case, remember that the num, okay, let's do that. So this is number of misplaced tiles, and we know that it's 7. The question is it admissible? The question is it admissible? We can argue, is this heuristic admissible? How do you compute the distance? What is the cost measure in 8 puzzle? One per move. Each time you move a move the blank into a different space, that's an extra move. Okay. All I'm asking is it true that the number of moves you make to go from here to here will always be more than the number of misplaced tiles? The answer is yes. Because, in fact, I'm making an abstraction here. The abstraction I'm making is that I can magically go from any place to any place in one move. That's exactly what I did when I'm counting the misplaced tiles. Remember, you know, we were talking about where heuristics come from. Heuristics come from abstractions. The question is, what is the abstraction that's being used here? The abstraction that's being used here is I can just jump and go to wherever I want to go. So if I'm in the wrong place, one move I'll be in the right place. That's what I did. Okay, that is, first of all, it's an abstraction. It's a really bad abstraction. It's very high level abstraction. Okay, but it is an abstraction all the same, and it would be admissible. The only reason you should not take blank is if you were to take, let's say, a scenario where everything, so suppose that my current state is exactly this, except 8 is here and blank is here. Right? How many real moves are needed to go from that state to the goal state? 1. How many misplaced tiles are there if you count blank? 2. So ding, you become inadmissible. And so you lose. Okay? This is the reason why you don't count the blank tile. Okay? That's point 1. Now, having said the abstraction in this level, what can I improve the abstraction? Well, don't assume that you can go, so basically, when I'm saying I can go from place to place, I'm thinking that I can pass through other blocks. Not only am I passing through other blocks, I would just, in fact, I'm flying. I'm not passing through. I'm flying. You know, I'm coming out of the board, going to wherever I want. A slightly better abstraction would be to say that I will pass through them, but I'll say, sorry, while I'm passing through them. So I'll go on the land, I won't be flying, but I'll be passing through you, I'll be pushing you out on my way, but I'll say sorry. That would get more moves, okay? So the moves, the idea is, if in this particular case, 5 is here, and it needs to be here, right? So what it would have to do is it has to say, sorry. Okay? Those were the number of moves it has to make. And it turns out that distance really is the Manhattan distance. Manhattan distance is essentially the distance between the x values, x coordinates, plus the distance between the y coordinates. That's the Manhattan distance. Okay? So you could have gone this, argon, this, either way, it's the same distance. So 5 would have to do at least 1, 2, 3, 4 moves to get to its correct place, which is obviously a bigger number than one move. And if you can keep the heuristic admissible, giving it a bigger number improves search. Right? Now the question is this admissible?
Well, you can only move one tile at a time, and you're going to have to move it at least a number of Manhattan distances.
It is admissible because you can, in fact, the number of moves that the tile has to travel may be more, but it cannot be less than this. Okay? So in this particular case, so if I compute the distances here, by the way, the numbers here are the number of moves the tile number 1 has to make, the tile number 2 has to make, etc. Tile number 1 is here. It needs to be here. So it has to make 1, 2 moves. Okay, tile number 2 is here, it needs to be here, it needs to make 1, 2, 3 moves. That's why 2 plus 3, etc. And the one which has to travel the most is 5, and that would be 4 moves. So you add up all the moves for each of the tiles that they have to make, okay, and you have the Manhattan distance, which is the sum of distances each of the tiles have to travel, assuming that they can pass through other tiles. Okay? Obviously, this is not possible. In fact, you can't pass through other tiles, so that's why it's an abstraction. Clearly, Manhattan distance is going to be also admissible, and clearly, is it more informed or less informed?
More
informed, because it'll be at least equal to number of misplaced tiles. It's costlier or cheaper to compute? Little costlier. I mean, we're talking still microseconds, but it's a little costlier compared to this, because here you just count up, here you have to actually at least do x1. By the way, if you are given, in case you haven't figured this out, if you are given x1, y1, and x2, y2 as the coordinates of 2 points on the plane, the normal Euclidean distance is x1 minus x2, square plus y1 minus y2 square. Manhattan distance is absolute value of x1 minus x2 plus absolute value of y1 minus y2. So you don't actually have to look at this puzzle and see one piece by one piece. All you need to do is compute that expression. That's it. Yes?
And it's pretty easy to get x2, y2 because you could just make a table.
Yeah, because you have the places. In fact, when you are representing these, you have to remember where they are. It's an array. Let's say in the project, you are thinking of these as an array, the puzzle as an array, and each tile is in a position in the array. The indices of the array will tell you the x and y coordinates. Right? It's a little costlier, but it's obviously better. So clearly, Manhattan distance would win compared to H1 in computing the optimal distances. Now, here is so if you look at the performance of these heuristics, 8 puzzle, you can solve 8 puzzle, even 10 years back, you can solve 8 puzzle, either with misplaced or with Manhattan, very easily, even with cheap computers, okay? 15 puzzle could not be solved with misplaced tiles, because it wind up taking too many expansions. But it could be solved with Manhattan distance. It is easy to solve it with Manhattan distance. When I say solve, given any arbitrary initial and goal state configurations that are actually solvable, remember that we actually can have initial and goal state configurations that are not solvable at all, because they correspond to swapping the tiles. Okay? If they are indeed actually solvable, then you can solve it before you die, essentially, within like an hour or so for 15 puzzles, even 10 years back. Now, in fact, it can be solved under minutes if you do good data structure. Okay? That's the deal. Optimal solution length average 53 moves. If you consider all possible start and goal nodes, you're talking 53 moves. Okay? That's big. that's really, really, really big. Why is it really, really, really big? 53 is the depth. What's the branching factor, approximately? It can be 4. It is somewhere between 4 or lower. So in the worst case, you're talking about 4 for 53 as the search tree. And you're actually solving this. It's nice. Okay? And you would be about generating, for good things, you could generate good implementations, you could generate about 400 million nodes on the average. And by the way, notice, you use IDA star. You have no hope of solving these problems if you use A star, because you run out of memory way before you run out of patience. Because you are generating 400 million nodes by the time the search is over. Okay? An average solution time, this I don't know when is current. I think this was about 6 years back. This slide was made by Rich Karp. And at that time, the average solution time for 15 puzzle is 50 seconds per problem. Pretty darn good. Okay. Okay. What's the limitations on Manhattan distance? What if I'm not happy with 8 puzzle, I'm not happy with 15 puzzle, I want 24 puzzle. I am a masochist. Okay. To solve 24 puzzles with IDA star using Manhattan distance would require 65,000 years, 6 years back. Since Microsoft has been busy improving their operating system, making it slower, but at the same time, the CPUs have become faster. I think it may be as low as 40,000 years now, okay? But still low, somewhat on the high side. Okay, for an arbitrary instance of 24 puzzles. 24 puzzles, the darn thing looks so easy, right? But clearly, pretty darn hard problem. Okay. Now, why is it that bad? Why is it that bad? Obviously, you thought its abstraction is slightly better than the abstraction made by the number of misplaced tiles, but it's still far from a reasonable abstraction. So in essence, what is happening is that you are hoping, in that picture that I showed you, you are hoping that the overall cost of search will fall towards the cheaper heuristics rather than towards the middle somewhere. But you're unlucky. That's not true in this problem. Okay? So the question then is, what's your next idea for 8 puzzle problems? So of course, I mean, any puzzle problem, what's your next idea? Of course, you always can say, I'll do 8 star. Okay? And in fact, you can just generate 8 star values for all the pairs of S and G values and store it in a huge big terabyte sized memory, and you can get by, for example. Okay, but if you start talking about amortized cost, how much time you spent computing the heuristic and how much you used it, it's still a bad idea. So the question is, between Manhattan and H star, are there other points? Just as between ignoring obstacles versus circular obstacles, there was another point, which is, I'm sorry, between circular obstacles versus full obstacles, there was other points that we had, which were generalized polygonal approximations, where, in fact, you could put a bound on the number of sides you would consider for any polygon. And if you say generalized polygonal approximation with polygons being at most 15 sides or less, that would be a worse approximation than a one which allows 25 sides or less. Okay, so there's a nice way you can increase the cost you spend during heuristic while increasing its informedness in that problem. Is there one for this? There were some raised hands. Yes. What? Yeah, you can give up on lots of things, including admissibility. But it is interesting that we cannot, I mean, you clearly can give up on admissibility. But before giving up, it's worth knowing, you know, what is it that's killing us here. Yes. What?
Just think of the problem as trying to move one side into its right position and make a valid set of moves and count the number of.
That's actually a very good idea, but you can do it even better. So what he was saying, by the way, is the following. Let's see. here in Manhattan distance, you thought five, for five to come to its real position, right? You assumed if it can pass through places, then it'll go 1, 2, 3, 4 positions, and it'll get to its right position. But in fact, it's not five. It's not in this particular case. It's not going to be that simple. If you want to do legal moves for five, if all I care is everything else remains the same, five should come to its right position. And if I computed the true cost of getting five to its correct position, then I can guarantee that that number would be a lower bound on the optimal cost of getting everybody into right position.
Could you count the number of empty space moves such that an empty space is in the next closest?
But that's basically what legal moves are.
Yeah.
You can only move empty space. The question is, tell me how to get five from here to here, really speaking.
Well, you have to move, what I'm saying is you have to move the empty space to the left of it.
Okay, that is one. So you get here, but then five comes here, then what do? You actually have to solve this problem. You have to get, there may be some number of instances. I'm not good at this puzzle. You know, that's why I teach AI. So it's definitely not going to be four moves. And it requires search. But the search is smaller, hopefully, than the search for the entire puzzle. And what's interesting is it's admissible. Okay? So instead of each puzzle, each tile taking its passing through puzzle distances, if you, for each tile you take the true number of moves, ignoring everybody else. Now when you say ignore, what do I mean? What I mean is, these guys are warm bodies. They don't have numbers. I don't care about their numbers. So imagine if I'm interested in getting five to its correct position, then what I really think of is a puzzle version where this is white tile, white tile, white tile, white tile, white tile, white tile, white tile. Blank. Five. So remember the Schindler's List, where millions of, you know, people were running on the road because, you know, they were being, the Jews were being evicted and so on. And you consider one little girl in pink, just so that you can focus on what happens to her. So essentially that's what I'm doing. I'm focusing on five. Everybody else becomes black, basically white. That means they have no they are indistinguishable. And five needs to get through them. So they are warm bodies. They need to be put out of place. But I don't care whom I am putting out of place. Okay? If you count that distance, that would be the optimal number of moves to get five to its correct position, ignoring everything else. Just a second. Okay? If I get that number, that would be definitely greater than four, and it will be definitely a lower bound. The next question I have is, suppose I do this for every one of the tiles. So first consider the true cost for five. Then now make five indistinguishable, make four the pink girl. You know, so four now is our guy, and you want to get four to its correct position, ignore everybody else. I mean, so that means they become indistinguishable. And you count the actual number of moves needed. Okay? And you add those numbers up instead of these numbers. Is that going to be admissible?
No, it might not be. You might.
Who said no? Why? Why?
Because while you are doing the first one, actually the other might have been closer to the goal.
Okay? So the problem is, it's a great idea that you started. That's like the start of the polygonal idea. But now I want to improve it. Polygon with one side, polygon with five sides at most, polygon with 10 sides at most. The easiest way to improve would be to not just consider one guy, but consider every guy and add up their values. But that doesn't work, unfortunately. Because what happens is that there are interactions between the nodes, between the tiles, such that the cost can be more. The estimated cost could be more than the real cost. Because in trying to get five to its correct position, you may already have done all the work needed to get four to its correct position.
So could you do it as just kind of you maintain the state as you calculate the solution?
Yeah, so something like that is what we're going to do. Yes?
Can we improve this approach by dividing that calculation by two, something like that?
Okay, so what we will do is this. We will consider a pattern. Okay? So consider the goal size. In this particular goal configuration, I'll assume the goal configuration is such that the blank puzzle, the blank tile is always in the top left hand corner. And then it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. That's the goal configuration. Okay? Suppose I, for any random configuration, I need to get it to the goal configuration in optimal number of moves. Suppose I decided to take a pattern. One simple pattern is just 15. That's the pattern. So get 15 to its correct position. That's the pattern. A bigger pattern is get this and this correct. Get me the, you know, what the left, the rightmost and the bottommost fringe correct. If I compute the number of moves needed, now notice that what, to do that I will essentially 3, 7, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. So I'll only care about those guys. These are the pink girls now. Everybody else becomes indistinguishable. So in a way this puzzle is simpler because there are some named entities whose positions we actually care about, and there are unnamed entities who do stop us from getting to where we want to go, but you can, it doesn't really matter where they wind up being in the end. Now, first point is, if I compute this, the distance, the optimal distance here for getting these tiles to the correct position is going to be a lower bound on the true optimal distance of getting this entire configuration into the goal configuration. Point one. Point two, it's going to be better, obviously, way better than Manhattan distance. In this particular case, Manhattan distance for this puzzle configuration is about 19 moves. But the true number of moves you need to do to get these to the right places is at least 31 moves. So that's the optimal number of moves. 31 is less than optimal, as we know. I mean, as because I'm just giving you that, because getting this in shape would ensure that whatever you do in getting this shape is at least as hard or cheaper than getting everything in shape. Okay. Similarly, one more example. So suppose in the, with the same goal configuration, suppose I have a different start state configuration for the same goal configuration. In fact, one thing that people do in puzzle problems is they sort of assume there is a standard end configuration. Like Rubik's Cube, there is a standard end configuration. Okay? And you, wherever random place you are trying to get to the standard ending configuration. Similarly, I can assume that there is a standard goal node configuration for this. And wherever I am, I need to get there. And for any new configuration I give for my tiles, all I need to do is consider only the puzzle tiles that are in the pattern I care about, the fringe pattern I care about, and think of how to get them to the right place. Now, all these white squares, they are not blank. Only this guy is blank. These are obstacles, nameless obstacles. I don't even have to say sorry to them. I just have to get them out of the way when I'm moving through them. Okay? So, in this case, the Manhattan distance would be 20 and the actual number of moves needed would be 28. And in this case, Manhattan distance is 17, actual number of moves needed is 27. In all these cases, as you can see, I mean, the actual distance, the heuristic that I'm computing here is much better. Because more informed, significantly more informed. Yes?
Can you take a look at the initial position on the tile and say which corner you want to put the fringe pattern?
Say? That's up to you. All I'm saying is there are many different ways I can look at the fringe pattern. Okay? All I'm saying is this is, you cannot just assume, so you can pick a fringe pattern and compute the heuristic for with respect to that fringe pattern. Now notice that suppose you use this as the fringe pattern and that lazy guy over there said, hey, no, I don't want the entire fringe, I don't care about this, just get the bottom line correct. Okay? Who is going to be more informed? The guy who gets more of the puzzle into the correct space is going to be more informed, or at least as informed, as the guy who only gets the bottom part in the correct place.
What is the heuristic used to
get? Why won't it be? Because remember, I'm talking about subsumption, at least as good. I'm not saying it's definitely better. So if I'm getting this path into correct position anyway, then at best I could have accidentally got those into the correct position. At worst, I have to do a lot more work to get them into the correct position. Which one? I agree. But all I'm saying is, think about what we are saying. You cannot do better in getting. So if the argument is that doing this whole thing into the correct position is strictly cheaper than doing just this, that makes no sense, because then that argument would lead you to say that the entire puzzle is cheaper than getting any piece of it into the correct place. It may well be that getting it's just small piece of the puzzle into the correct place winds up being 99% of the work, but it'll never be 101% of the work. Just makes no sense. It's just common sense. Yes. Yeah. Go ahead.
What was the heuristic you used to get the pieces, the fringe pieces, in the appropriate location?
No, I'm counting. I'm actually going to do a search from here. What is the distance from here to here? That's what I'm going to count. Okay? And what I'm going to do, just a second. Okay? So the question is now, how would I actually go about computing this heuristic? I sort of ensured that it is more informed. It's going to be costlier than Manhattan distance, right? It's not anymore x1 minus x2 magnitude plus y1 minus y2 magnitude. You have to do real search. Now, in this particular case, in this kind of a 7-pattern tile, you would wind up, the idea is you pre-compute for every start configuration, you pre-compute the distance you need to get to the goal configuration. Now remember that the start configuration, if I'm thinking that this is my fringe that I'm going to be caring about, this is my pattern, then the database for this pattern would be any configuration of only the red tiles. I don't care about the white tiles. For every possible different configuration of the red tiles, I need a number. That's all I need. Okay? It turns out that there are about 519 million configurations of those 7 tiles, even if you ignore the rest of the tile places.
And those are based on actual...
It's actually every possible place you can have. So for example, if I have 14 here and 3 here, that's a different configuration. But if I have 10 here, 5 here, 10 here, that's still the same configuration. The idea is it's a smaller problem, okay? And it's cheaper to compute, but you do a huge amount of pre-computation. Now, how do I actually go about doing the pre-computation? Since I know that I am actually going to use, given the goal state, I'm going to have to find out for every other state, I need a number. So the easiest thing to do, it turns out, easiest thing to do, it turns out, is remember that everything else other than these red guys are white. So here it's white and these are red puzzles, red tiles with their numbers. Easiest thing is to start with this state as the root node. And write a child generator function only with respect to this state. So you can still move the blank and to get the obstacle out of your way, but the two tile positions which only differ in terms of their white tiles, two puzzle positions which only differ in terms of their white tiles are the same. So you start from this and do breakfast, essentially, and compute the distances for all the possible start configurations. You do a pretty brute force thing up front. And if you do that, then you can use that huge database that you have, 519 million possible start states and their numbers. You use that during the real search. During the real search, when you get a board position, you ignore everybody other than the pattern tiles, hash into the database, find out what's the distance for that pattern, and use that as a heuristic. Now, look at how far this is from the happy-go-lucky Manhattan distance, and even happier-go-luckier misplaced tiles heuristic. Okay, if you look at the picture that I drew earlier, except now for the heuristics for the puzzle problem, here is H0, which is ignore H. This is somewhere very close to this is number of misplaced. In fact, these should be much closer here. This number of misplaced, this is Manhattan distance. And then as you go forward, these are all the pattern database style heuristics with bigger and bigger patterns. And the hope essentially in the past was somehow the minimum is more towards this side. But the practice has essentially told us that the only way you can solve 24 puzzle problem is to use reasonable pattern databases, reasonably sized. In fact, that 7-sized pattern database was used to solve 24 puzzle effectively. Okay? So you wind up doing a lot more work upfront, but then all that matters is the total amount of work. So if you get done in 2 years, as against 65,000 years, it's good, right? You know, to the extent you want to see the answer for this. Okay? And in fact, this leads to all sorts of beautiful ideas. So if you submit a paper on search nowadays to AAAI, which is the National Conference on AI, you get, they review your paper and the reviewers write comments on your paper. And then there is a feedback phase where the authors get to see the reviews and tell the reviewers, look, you guys didn't understand my paper, you're dunderheads, and this is the reason why it's good. They won't say it impolitely because it's not good. But you know, they will try to get the rebuttal. Now there was one paper that Rich Korff wrote recently, which somebody, the reviewer said, oh, by the way, for this better heuristic, you haven't yet shown the results for the larger 24 puzzle instance. And during the feedback phase, Rich Korff, and he doesn't know, I mean, I was the program chair, so I knew who was asking and who was answering at that time. But basically Rich Korff said, we actually, it just completed yesterday. Okay, there were 15 days, I mean, close to a month between the time the paper was submitted and the paper was being reviewed. So the search just completed yesterday, and in fact, the number of nodes is this, and the optimal distance is this. Right? Far, far from the old 310 days where you get mad if, in fact, the thing doesn't come back to you in like 3 seconds. I'm not saying we should get used to waiting for three days, but you should be happy that you could take something which would have taken 65,000 years, and by thinking of spending more time upfront using pattern database style heuristics, you got it down to just 15 days. In fact, it's much less. In fact, that particular problem was different, but 24 puzzle is within reach now. And if the 24 puzzle is within reach, what else would you want to do if we have nothing else to do in our life? And that is way out of reach still. Okay? Okay. So any questions on this pattern database style heuristics? Yes?
So did that become feasible on, say, personal computers in the mid-90s because of the multi-gigabyte hard drives, or were the processors still just...
We are not done yet, unless you actually have to leave.
Oh.
Okay. No, go ahead. Yeah.
I was thinking in the mid-90s, since you first started getting multi-gigabyte hard drives on personal computers, were the processors, would you say they were fast enough to reasonably do the 24 thing, including computing the table?
Yeah, no, so again, I think part of what you're saying is maybe I should avoid doing anything. The computing power can itself improve to the extent that things that couldn't be done 2 years back could be done now. It'll never be the case that something which would take 65,000 years will take 2 days because of Bill Gates' generosity. Okay? We do need to, these have to go hand in hand. We need to think of better ways of trading off heuristic computation cost versus the actual search cost.
Oh yeah, that's kind of the point of big O notation anyway.
Yeah, and the other thing also is the importance of space has become less as time went on, because remember Bill Gates was saying nobody would need more than 480 kilobytes of memory at one time. Not memory, the entire thing, 480 kilobytes is enough. And in fact, Windows, the bubble doesn't even come up with 480 kilobytes now. You know, I mean, you need like a gazillion gigabytes of disk and then at least 2 gigabytes of RAM just to get through life. But what it does mean is we have more memory, so more of the memory restrictions are reduced. But the speed at which the size of the problems has gone is mostly because of the heuristics improvement. And the improvement in heuristic in this case it's hard to be excited, unfortunately, about an idea like this, right? It looks, it's still brute force. You know, it would have been so nice if there was some sort of a beautiful idea that, boom, gives you the number. Unfortunately, there's no boom number for most problems. And so you need to get by with reasonable ways of getting the heuristic values. Yes. Now again, I am at this point talking about optimality of the search. We will come back to, in fact, the very next thing we'll be talking about is doing local search, where all optimality guarantees are out the window. But it may never complete either. Okay? So you do everything, not just one thing in this class. I mean, so that the people who don't care about optimality are still fine, you know, but today's class was not supportive for you. But it's worth for a computer science student to know that this silly 24 puzzle problem can keep going for 65,000 years. Okay, when was the last problem that you thought of which took 64,000 years to solve on any computer before this class? Okay, that's the question. So, the next thing that I would do next class when we come back is hill climbing algorithms. And from there, we would talk briefly about hill climbing algorithms, which is local search, and then go from there to constraint satisfaction problems, which is chapter 5 in the textbook. Okay? We stop here.